Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, the Trump administration unfroze some federal money for after-school programs, but those programs are still worried about the future. And singer-songwriter Ben Queller on keeping up a sense of adventure even during difficult times. But first, it is time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
We don't know if he killed himself. We don't know if there was a conspiracy on that one, but a lot of people have a lot of answers about this. And that's why I've called for the releasing of this information for years.
As Democrats showed up to ICE centers, the Department of Homeland Security tried to stop us by changing their guidance to try and prevent us from showing up unannounced. We will not back down, and we will keep showing up to hold them accountable.
I am not second guessing. I think we need to look at, after we get this fire managed, what went into the decision making, and if there were missteps, how we learn from that.
I think you've made a mockery of our state law related to school finance. I think you should be ashamed of yourself for how you have mistreated and abused the taxpayers of the Tolleson Union.
Federal law requires FEMA to anticipate the needs of states in disasters, to coordinate proactively, and not to wait on the state's request for positioning resources.
During our audits, every single day we catch something that represents misspending or inappropriate spending.
And with me to break down the latest campaign finance reports, some new entrants into next year's elections and more, our former state lawmaker, Regina Cobb. Regina, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing well. And Attorney Tom Ryan. Tom, good morning to you.
Top of the morning to you, Mark.
So, guys, let's start with the second quarter campaign finance numbers. A bunch of races that we could get to. I want to start with the gubernatorial campaign. Karen Taylor-Robeson brought in about $575,000 plus a couple million dollar loan. Congressman Andy Biggs, about $429,000. Regina, when you look at these numbers, how significant are they, especially considering that the conventional wisdom is that money isn't really going to be much of an issue in this race for either candidate?
I agree with you. When you look at Turning Point funding, Andy Biggs is, that's not even included in on that $426,000 mm-hmm. that you were talking about. That's just an addition to that. I think what's going to be significant is how they utilize it. You see that Karen Taylor-Robeson's already got $2.2 million, I think, in media ads already set aside without any, before she's even, she hasn't put out an ad, but she's got them set
aside. Well, she had a bunch earlier, but then stopped for a little while. Yeah,
but that's not what's out there.
Right.
I think that they're going to, I think that's what's going to impact it is how they utilize those funds.
Would you anticipate that this is, if not the most, one of the most expensive gubernatorial primaries in state history?
I do. It is very expensive. I had said years ago that we should be putting limits on campaigns. I think if you put a limit and it's kind of like, you know, sports. You got a limit on how much you can spend on your players.
Like a salary cap.
A salary cap. Yeah. Yeah. And if we did that, I think that would be, that would make a fairness model. Right now, it's not. It's not that way. So I disagree with the way that we just allow it to explode like it has.
I agree with the idea of limits. The problem is we have Citizens United that said money equals free speech. I disagree with the concept that money equals free speech. Money is inert. It's an object. It's not an action like free speech is. Money buys you access to speech, but it in and of itself is not free speech. But going back to the essential question here is how is this all going to play out? Number one, you've got both Robeson and Biggs having Trump's endorsement. Right now, that's a wash for them. Secondly, it's not clear how valuable that will be by 2026, given all of the current problems with the Epstein disclosures that seem to be slow rolling out right now. It doesn't seem to be any end to that. One thing to keep in mind, the primary is one thing. Last year, or the last time around, Robeson spent $22 million on her primary and did not beat not a great candidate, Carrie Lake. Both Robeson and Biggs have not won statewide elections like Hobbs has. And Hobbs has been, I know they're going to make a big deal about her veto record, but she has been a lot more bipartisan in her approach than the other side wants her to be. I think that's going to be very effective for her.
Tom, if you are the Katie Hobbs campaign, are you watching these two Republican candidates raising and otherwise getting a lot of money? Presumably, some amount of it will be used on negative ads or attacking the other. In some ways, for Hobbs, might that be a good thing that these two Republican candidates are, you know, try to tear each other down a little bit before they get to her in the general?
I do. And here's the thing. They will not tear each other down over their relationship to Trump, but that's something that Hobbs will have as her opposition research when it comes time for the general. And, you know, this whole Epstein thing is not playing out well right now for Mr. Trump.
Regina, is there a way, do you think, in the primary for the two of them? Obviously, there will be some number of attack ads and other, you know, not nice things said from one to the other. Is there a way to keep it so that it's not too damaging when they get to the general election?
I don't think you ever can do that. I think if you got opposition in your primary, you're gonna have some negative campaigning, and it might not even come from the candidate itself. It's probably coming from whoever's going to be doing the IEs, yeah. The independent expenditures. They're gonna. Those are usually where the negative ad comes. That way it doesn't come from the candidate themselves.
Right, you let somebody else do sort of the dirty work there.
Yeah, somebody else do the dirty work.
Oh, yeah, those IEs are brutal.
Brutal, they are.
and not necessarily honest either. They tend to overstate things, misstate things, and, you know.
And they can.
Yeah.
And there's no consequences on saying, I mean, you could throw it out there. It's hard to pull it back.
Tom, are you guys suggesting that in politics things are not always 100% honest and truthful? Wait,
look,
what?
You can go back to Thomas Nast. I mean, this is going on for a long time.
Wow.
Well, I think what's changed though is, and I think Regina's hit the nail on the head. It's the money that is allowed in here, and the problem is it's also disassociated the parties from their ability to control who the candidates are, so that they're more mainstream. Allowing money to control things as opposed to letting the parties control things has not been good for either party.
Yeah, I agree with that. One thing that we haven't talked about as far as the gubernatorial campaign is that we have a lieutenant governor now.
Right.
And
we will.
I'm thinking whoever, I mean, they don't have to come out with a lieutenant governor until their general election. But if they come out with a lieutenant governor and that person is a little bit more mainstream, somebody that is likable, whoever Biggs or Karen Taylor Robeson pick, I think will have a lot of influence on that.
Could we have a Lieutenant Governor Cobb?
That's no. What I was just going to – you beat me to the punch. If you're listening.
I have not. I
don't mean
not
to put you on the spot.
I'm not in the running right now. Thank you, though.
All right. Well, let's talk about another election that is coming up, and this is going to have sort of some dominoes around the valley and around the state house. State Representative Jeff Weninger is going to be running for Chandler mayor. We learned last week that the current mayor, Kevin Harkey, is going to be running for the House. That one of the other current House member from that district is running for the Senate because the current senator, J.D. Mesnard, is termed out. This is one of the more competitive legislative districts in the state. It has had a Democrat representing it not that long ago, just a couple of years ago. So I guess, Tom, like when you see sort of these musical chairs, is this potentially an opening if Democrats get the right candidate to pick up a seat in the state legislature?
If the Democrats can get their act together, the answer is yes. And I'm not too hopeful about that right now. They are Democrats are in disarray in the state of Arizona. There's no mistaking that. But LD-13 is a competitive district. Jennifer Pollack was the mm-hmm. representative.
That's your neck of the woods in the valley, right?
It's my district, yeah. So I know a lot about this. So I raised my hand like Horshack here. Ooh, Mr. Cotter. First off, Kevin Harkey is a very popular mayor. I believe he's a registered Republican, but he's run very much right of center and center. So I think he's going to do well there. The big issue, though, is going to be the mayor of Chandler, because Jeff Weninger is a well-known businessman, restaurateur in Chandler, but but he'll be up against Matt Orlando. The controversy—
Current city council member.
Current city council member. Yeah, he's been there before and he's come back. The controversy, which yesterday came out, there was a ruling on this yesterday in the Ruth Jones versus City of Chandler matter, is what is the meaning of the term limits? Is it just two terms as council member, and then you have to take off 4 years before you can run for two terms as Chandler mayor? That didn't get resolved in the ruling yesterday. The ruling yesterday was simply, dear Ms. Jones, you had a chance to say he was not qualified when he got elected. You didn't do it. You lose. So there is going to be a special election in November where the issue will be resolved, and it looks like the choice will be two terms as city council member, two terms as mayor, and that will be the term limits as opposed to separating them out by 4 years.
I think you got a win-win situation in Chandler right there with Jeff Winninger. He is an amazing legislator and a businessman, pro-business. What he's done with the Diamondbacks this year— his Diamondbacks bill.
Yeah, the Chase Field
renovation. The Chase Field renovation.
Yeah.
I mean, you go back on his record, there's no way you can lose in Chandler.
Regina, do you see this as a potential? I mean, in theory, Senator Mesnard could run for the House again. He served there, he was the Speaker of the House. I would imagine if he and Mayor Harkey run, they probably have a pretty good chance of both getting elected. But if Senator Mesnard chooses not to run, is it hard to find another Republican candidate there? Is it a chance for the right Democratic candidate to maybe win?
There's a chance, but I agree with Tom. I don't think the Democrats will get their stuff together. I think they're not going to. If they were focused on this, I think they could do it. It has been done before, and they've had a good candidate with Jennifer Pollack when she was in there.
Mm-hmm.
And both sides worked well together. Winninger, J.D. Mesnard, Pollack, all of them worked really great together. But I don't— there's a chance, but I feel like it's going to be taken by the Republicans.
I see Mesnard running for higher office, not just city of, not again for the House. He's been there, done that, and I think you're going to see him run for something else.
Okay.
But yeah, it's when Jennifer Pollack got elected, there were people knocking at the door. There were door hangers. The precinct committeemen had multiple offices taken out. There was a real effort, and they did a single shot.
Right. One candidate of a party in a district.
Yeah. Correct.
Right.
That's how you win it right now. But I just don't see it happening. And getting rid of this whole executive director election, the chair
of the Democratic Party,
has been a difficult, painful thing.
I don't think they could come out of.
Debacle. That's a good dentistry word.
All right. On that note, let's take a quick break. Tom Ryan, Regina Cobb, I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, attorney Tom Ryan and former state lawmaker Regina Cobb. Regina, let me start with you on Governor Katie Hobbs went to Washington, D.C. this week. She met with a bunch of people, including the Secretary of the Interior, Doug Burgum, who apparently told her that there would be an investigation into the fire up on the north rim of the Grand Canyon that burned down the Grand Canyon Lodge and some other structures up there. There's been a lot of consternation, some bipartisan calls for an investigation into that. Are you surprised at all that the federal government has said, sure, we'll look into this?
No, I think there has to be something looked into this. When they decided that all of a sudden they're just going to look at it as a controlled burn, you don't do that in the Grand Canyon area. I mean, you have a lot of yellow pine in there. We're never going to get those back. What about the historic lodge? I mean, I've been a rim-to-rim hiker for years. I've probably done it a dozen times, and I'm just devastated that lodge is gone, and I feel like that we lost a piece of history there. It should be investigated.
Tom, is there a way to keep this from becoming a political issue or political weapon in some way?
Yeah, I think so. In fact, I think by the mere fact that these two, one current governor and former governor, sat down and talked to each other, one Democrat, one Republican, and they agreed on things, is a way to keep it from becoming, as the popular word is now, weaponized politically. I'm proud of Burgum for having the courage to sit down and talk honestly with Hobbs, and I'm also happy for Hobbs saying, hey, I'm putting aside political difference. This is for the state of Arizona. And actually, because the Grand Canyon is a national park, it's also a national treasure, this is a national issue. What I think is good about this is it shows that Katie Hobbs can run a center-right, center-left, center-based governor's office. I think it's good for her, and it turns out to be good for Arizona. Anytime we have politicians who work across the aisle, like Regina used to do here, that's good for everybody. So I don't see it as weaponized. I think it's going to be great.
It's interesting, Regina. It seems like over the years, the Grand Canyon has been one of the issues, maybe one of the few issues, that has really brought different groups of people, different parties together, be it, you know, during a federal government shutdown, governors from all sorts of parties have said, we'll reopen it. Or if there's an issue there, lawmakers and policymakers from both parties seem really concerned about this. Do you get the sense it's sort of a logistical thing? Like it's such a big component of the state's image, the state's economy, frankly? Or is there maybe something else that it just sort of has this sort of ephemeral feeling for Arizonans?
Well, I think it's historical. It's patriotic. No matter how you look at it, it is a national monument and it should be a national issue and everybody loves it. And so I think that those are the kind of issues you love to see people come together on. I remember during the Ducey administration when, you know, he said, if they're going to shut it down, we'll take over. We're not going to let it go down. And I love that. I want that. And I think now with Katie Hobbs doing, you know, the investigation and actually coming together with the federal government, a Republican federal government, and being able to do this, I think is a good thing for everybody in the state.
We are literally the Grand Canyon state.
Officially.
Officially.
We were the Valentine state, a little history here, but now we slapped it across our license plates, you know?
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's a big deal.
Regina, let's go back to elections for just a moment. And there's going to be a rematch, presumably a rematch, in northern Arizona with Congressman Eli Crane. The Republican incumbent will be facing off against Democrat Jonathan Nez, former president of the Navajo Nation. This is a race that was not particularly close last year, but I mean, people have said, you know, Nez did about as well as a Democrat could potentially do in that district. So maybe let's give him another run. Is it significant that, like, is it possible that he could do better the second time, or are we looking at same candidate, same result?
Again, the Democrat Party is not organized, and I think for Nez to do better, he's going to have to be more organized and have more support behind him. The Navajo or the Nation is 20% of that district, and not historically he's going to have to get them out to vote. Mm-hmm. They're not historically voters. And so when you look at who votes, it's going to be difficult for him to raise those numbers.
Tom, it looks like you have a chart in front of you.
I did, because this one's interesting to me. First off, a congressional district 2 is huge. It covers Apache, Coconino, Gila County, Graham County, Maricopa, Mojave, Navajo, Pinal, and Yavapai.
That's almost all the counties in the state.
It does.
Yeah. There are only 15 counties, and I think I just went through 8 of them there, 9 of them. Yeah, it's huge. But here's the thing. He, in every one of the Democratic ones, Jonathan Nez knocks it out of the ballpark. He gets killed in the Republican ones, and they're big. Pinal is big. Yavapai and Gila are all big, and he wasn't even close in those. The other thing is I looked at the cash on hand from the last time, $1.4 million for Eli Crane at the end of his last campaign, and Jonathan Nez, $226,000. That's a huge difference. And so I agree with Regina. If there's going to be a chance, it's got to come out of the Navajo Nation, and there really has to be a get-out-the-vote effort there.
I also wonder, given all that we're hearing about, you know, midstream redistricting in places and, you know, some Republican states are trying to redistrict to give themselves an advantage, and Democratic states are saying, if you do that, we're going to do this. I wonder if that affects the amount that that national groups might be able to spend on a race like this, if they maybe have other sort of unexpected races that they have to either defend or suddenly become competitive. Those take precedent, and someone like Nez is kind of left out in the cold in terms of national support.
And you're absolutely right. I don't think I'm not sure about the redistricting, doing a midterm redistricting. You saw how long it takes to redistrict, and then there was lawsuits that went that occur afterwards. So I think if they're going to start pulling that, it's going to be really difficult.
One of the things we saw this last week is after Trump and Abbott announced that they may be looking at redistricting in Texas, Gavin Newsom engaged in the game of mutually assured destruction.
Destruction.
Okay, you want to do that? We'll do the same here in California. We'll make sure we get the exact same amount that you're doing there.
You can't focus on your political campaigns if you're going to be doing something like that. That's huge.
Who your constituency is matters.
And if it changes halfway through, I would imagine, I mean, you're the one in the room who's been elected to something. I would think that would be hard.
Really difficult. Yeah, because you're planning. You already planned. You know where you're going and how you did. I had a district that was 8 hours from top to bottom driving.
Yeah.
And I had to plan that out ahead of time, where I was going to be at what time, when, how I was going to do it. I can imagine if that switched in midstream, I would be lost.
One of the nice things about Arizona is we did pass the Independent Redistricting Commission.
Yeah.
And that was a smart move. It has been manipulated a bit in the past. That's a discussion for another show. But all in all, I think it's basically worked well.
All right, guys, just a couple of minutes left, and we really don't have enough time to get into this too much. But I want to ask you each about this, the Tolleson Unified School District deciding to help out the Isaac School District, which earlier this year had a whole thing where they were placed into receivership and all. Now a number of GOP lawmakers, Regina, want an investigation into this. They don't like the fact that Tolleson has engaged in sort of a lease buyback arrangement where they're going to lease the buildings and sell them back with some interest. Does this become a political issue, or it could seem like one that's kind of complicated for voters?
Well, what I think is a political issue, part of it is the superintendent was also a consultant. I mean, you got a conflict of interest there. I think there needs to be an investigation on how that swap was done.
And with the Tolleson superintendent.
With the Tolleson, yes, exactly.
I think the question becomes whether or not any investigation is going to be performative or will it be actual. Look, our government in the state of Arizona has engaged in this very same thing with state buildings in the past.
During the Great Recession, sold off and leased back the Capitol.
Absolutely. And so the question, it was under Jan Brewer.
Governor Brewer, yeah.
Yes. And so it's not like it hasn't happened before. And it's not illegal, immoral, improper, or even fattening or unethical. It's just a matter of if there's a conflict.
And it has to pass a smell test,
right.
And it's not.
Right.
And that's what they're investigating. So that's the problem here. You can it follows the law. There's nothing illegal about what they're doing. Is it right? I don't know. We've got to look into it and make sure that everybody's doing what they are supposed to be doing.
Do you expect that there will be an investigation?
I do. I do. I think JLAC, if nothing else, is going to audit this.
The Joint Legislative Audit Committee.
Yep.
Yeah, that would be the group to do it. Tom, would you expect an audit or investigation of some sort?
Oh, yeah. They've pretty much announced it. And I think for their various reasons, they're going to go through with it. What they find will be a different story.
All right. That'll be interesting to see. All right. Tom Ryan, Regina Cobb, thanks so much to you both. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, singer-songwriter Ben Queller on learning how to grapple with the loss of his son. But first, the Trump administration recently unfroze about $1 billion aimed at after-school and summer programs across the country. The 21st Century Community Learning Center money, though, is just part of the overall education money the feds had held back. There's about $6 billion that are still frozen, including around $100 million earmarked for Arizona. Among the groups that will now get the money that's been released is Boys and Girls Clubs of the Valley. They had about $1.3 million frozen by the administration. I spoke earlier with the organization's president and CEO, Marsha Mintz, and asked about the significance of finally getting that federal money after a nearly three-week delay.
Well, the nice thing about it being unfrozen is it actually is giving us some time to really figure out how we're going to continue to serve those 2,000 vulnerable youth for the long term. As people might not know, the money that was frozen was already committed for this year, but we also know that there is $0 put in the budget for next year. So we want to fix the problem, not just for right now, but we want to fix it for the future.
So does having that money coming in now allow you to do what you were expecting to do for at least this school year?
For this school year, yes, but it might be done in a different way. We're taking this time right now with each of our school partners to really evaluate what is the best way to even provide the service this year so we can continue it next year. Because if not, we're going to end up with the same problem next year, and that's not a long-term and sustainable solution.
What are some of the options? I mean, if you know that you're not getting federal money for the next school year, how do you try to adjust what you're doing now to keep that sustainable?
So I think we are absolutely going to lean on the philanthropic community to come forward and say, hey, we've identified with our schools the most vulnerable of youth in this position. Will you help us make sure they're hitting their academic achievements, getting those critical youth development and life skill pieces from 3 to 7 p.m.? And I think a good deal of the philanthropic community will step up. I also think it's working with schools in a different way to deliver out-of-school time programming, and it might look different than it has in the past, given the limited resources.
Yeah, I mean, do you have to maybe scale back now so that you maybe do less but can do it for longer?
It might be. You might need to scale it. I wouldn't say scale back, but do it in a different way. It could be, for example, maybe it's not till 7, maybe it's till 5 p.m., maybe we can actually go to our families and say, can you participate, or open it up to other youth and have some other families pay to help offset the cost of the program.
Understanding that this is still fairly early days since the unfreezing, I'm curious what you have heard from schools about all this, especially given that, you know, they're not necessarily sure about the rest of this funding.
So that's a huge challenge for schools. Many of them have chosen to not continue 21st century funding, even though the funding has unfrozen.
Mm-hmm.
And they're coming to Boys and Girls Club and saying, hey, we'll just send our kids to you. But that's not sustainable for us as well. We'd love to take in as many kids as possible, but there is an operational cost, you know, and there's, you know, for every 20 kids we take in, that's another staff person. There are really hard costs involved with continuing to serve kids, even in our existing facilities.
When you talk about needing to rely on the philanthropic community, what kind of support are you needing here? Like, I would imagine it's not a small number.
No, these are seven-figure problems. And I think when we've had challenges in the past, it's really taken the public and private sector to come together, the business community, the philanthropic community, and create some of those multi-year, long-term funding strategies to help get us to the place we need, give us that operating runway, really help us build stuff up and work with families. I will say our families do pay. They pay what they can. And for some families, they can pay the cost. And for many, they can't. So having that financial assistance and that scale really is what it's about, and helping as many kids as possible through financial assistance.
How do you think about what the programs themselves might look like, given the resources that you have or may have, and given what the needs are of the students that you're serving?
Unfortunately, the needs and what we're seeing has just increased. And it's very, very challenging for us as youth development professionals to say, oh, let's scale back or let's not provide this program. How do you choose between academic success and support, you know, healthy lifestyles, making kids sure kids are physically active, getting healthy, nutritious food, mental health support, arts, STEM, music, technology, AI programming? This is everything kids need today. And more importantly, those life skills, those social skills, how to interact with other people, and our career development program, which honestly starts in third grade. It's helping young people see here in Arizona what kind of careers of the future they could have. You know, how would you choose?
Given the timing of when this money was unfrozen and, you know, how Arizona is maybe a little different than the rest of the country, some schools had already started. Some were just about to get underway when the money was unfrozen. Some will be starting up, you know, in the next week or two. What did that mean, even though you have the money now for this school year? Did that impact what you're able to do or what schools were thinking they were going to do given the timing of this?
Absolutely. We started the conversation as soon as it was frozen on July 1st. And with some schools, we are looking at different ways to deliver the program this year to still serve the kids that were enrolled in the program. But you have to remember, a lot of schools just went on pause and they said, oh, we're just going to wait. And it's up to the schools to identify the students that really need to be in these programs. So I think they're trying to figure out how to do that now. But families are nervous. They're nervous about, you know, doing it this year and then what about next year? And I think that also impacts school choice. When parents are looking, especially working families, where to place their kids, they need to know they have a place after school, because then their jobs are not sustainable. And that's going to impact our workforce tremendously.
So understanding that crystal balls are often very cloudy, I'm curious, when you sort of close your eyes and think about what the future of these programs might look like, at this moment, what do you think?
I think we have to be as innovative as we can and as efficient as we can with the resources we have to try to, A, serve our existing club members and youth, and figure out a way to continue to serve more. Again, I think it could look differently. I think, you know, it might not be the same hours. It might not be the same location. It could be a different model of program delivery. But nothing is off the table at this point. And we have to really dig deep and figure out what's the most important services we can deliver to, you know, the youth who need us most and our working families. I think that it's important that this community, honestly, this state, this country, really do some soul searching about priorities right now and know that this is something that if you don't invest in right now, there is such a long-term ripple effect that would take, you could say, decades or a lifetime to catch up with, or never. And the question is, you know, what do we care about as a community and a society? My experience with this community here in Arizona has always been that they have stepped up for our youth and the most vulnerable youth. And I am extremely optimistic that they will do so again.
All right. That is Marcia Mintz, president and CEO of Boys and Girls Clubs of the Valley. Marcia, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Singer-songwriter Ben Queller is in Phoenix for a show this weekend. Queller has been touring and recording since he was 16 years old. Now 44, he recently released his seventh studio album called Cover the Mirrors. Queller spoke with my co-host Sam Dingman.
Ben, I have to start off by telling you that I am a huge fan, so I have some bias.
Thank you.
Your music has meant a tremendous amount to me. And if I could, I wanted to go back a little bit before we get to Cover the Mirrors and ask you about what is very much my favorite song of yours, which is Penny on the Train Track.
Ooh, nice one.
The line that has always really just kind of made me vibrate whenever.
Yes.
Whenever I hear it is, I see all these things that I should be.
I should be, yeah.
And I wonder if you could just tell me a little bit about where you were at when you wrote that line.
I grew up in Greenville, Texas, small town. My family had an old upright piano with broken keys, and that's what I started tinkering around on when I was like 4 or 5 years old. And fast forward, you know, I started bands and playing guitar, and eventually my band Radish signed a record deal to Mercury Records when I was 16. I went on tour, dropped out of high school, never looked back, and I've been doing it ever since. Yeah. And meanwhile, my parents have this lake house in Texas on this little lake, and we always would go there for the 4th of July, and we'd set up instruments on the deck. We called it Lake Fest, and it was basically just us jamming all
day. Oh,
that's
cool.
And one summer, the lake house was, you know, kind of a shabby shack. We noticed that there were like mouse droppings upstairs where I was sleeping, which was kind of lame because you're like, oh God, this is gross. And so I had to go to Walmart to get some mouse traps. And so I'm like down on my knees in like aisle 14 or wherever the mouse traps are. And then I hear a voice. This dude says, "Yo, is that Ben Queller?" So I turn around, and it's my friend Mike from high school, full police uniform.
Ran into a friend just the other day, got a badge. He's a local cop.
Local cop. You got it, bro.
Okay.
And so I sit down at that piano and I just start playing the opening riff in the key of D. I just started singing those words and they just came out of me.
Ran into a friend just the other night. Got a badge, he's a local cop. Haven't seen that boy in over 7 years. Since out of high school I dropped. I see
Not to be too pedantic, but can I probe you a little bit on the word should in the song? Because, you know, you see this friend who has turned out to be a cop, which, you know, some would say is the opposite of rock and roll.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
Exactly. And then there's another lyric where you see a friend who's living this, you know, very tranquil suburban life. He's making lemonade in a KitchenAid.
as the
song goes. And you say, it's grim when you wish that you were just like him.
And I say that because, especially now, like when we fast forward to the life I've had the past 2.5 years after losing my son, Dorian. And I say it's grim when you wish that you were him because it's not a good way to be if you're always looking over your shoulder, wanting to be something different.
Oh, that's fascinating. So that's directed at yourself, not at him necessarily.
Totally. When you can find acceptance from within, I mean, that's really all that matters. In that lyric, that's like a momentary feeling of like, gosh, yeah, that guy has it made. Wouldn't it be nice to be him? But actually, no, I wouldn't want to be anybody else.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it comes back to humility because, you know, you crave control as a human. We want to control what's happening to us.
Yeah.
On that night, February 27th, 2023, when Dorian was in the car crash, I had no control of anything. I was in complete chaos.
Yeah.
And so I'm losing my train of thought here.
No, that's okay.
We're going deep, bro. This is good. This is good.
Thank you for sharing all this. I appreciate it.
No, I'm happy to because I'm also just trying to learn what it is that I'm going through.
Can I ask you, I mean, there is a song called Oh Dorian that closes out the record. And on that song, you say of Dorian, my best friend, I can't wait to hang with you again.
Oh, yeah.
Is the idea there that you'll be reunited with Dorian?
It makes me cry to hear you say it back to me. But yeah, I do believe that. I believe I'm going to see him. And whether I'm right or wrong, that doesn't even matter. It's just the belief I'm going with, and it helps me get through each day without him.
Yeah. Well, if I'm not mistaken, you play one of Dorian's songs on the record, right?
I do.
Does that feel like a way of hanging out with him?
100%. And when we perform it live every night, I feel him there with me. And that was really special. That song, it's called Trapped. And it's a song he was working on. He started writing it. He was working on it for a few weeks leading up to his death. And I remember going into his bedroom and saying, dude, what is that? That's so cool. And he said, I know, it's just coming out of me. I don't know. And we sat down on the bed together with two guitars and messed around with it for a little bit, but he never quite finished it. And then fast forward a few months when I realized that I was making my new album and I just couldn't stop thinking about that song Trapped and how no one would ever get to hear it. And so I thought, okay, well, I'm going to try to finish it. And so I have a photo of him here in the studio above the door. And I just look up at him and say, all right, Dorian, bring me some lyrics. We're going to finish Trapped today. And we just started working on it. And it's a wild thing, you know, to write a song with a dead person. Like, what? That's just a different, but it can be done. I found out.
Now I'm gone. Yeah, I'm free. That's just how has to be. Cause you trap me every time.
on another one of your songs, the line you have in there that really resonates for me is "My love's extreme."
Yes. My wife always, she calls me Ben All or Nothing Queller because I'm either like all in on something or all out. I've never been able to play it cool.
Yeah. To go back to Penny on the Train track, I think that was the other thing I remember really, really appreciating about it when I heard it for the first time is there's this sense in it of like knowing that your life is meant for something, but you don't know what it is, but you do know that if you stay stagnant, you won't experience whatever that is. So you might as well just run as hard as you can towards that thing. And in particular, the line that always struck me was, if you can't get behind your own life, get behind the driving wheel. And just go.
Exactly.
I think that's the lyric. Just go.
That's it. Just go.
Just go. Find a place that you don't know.
You could just waste away on the couch forever, for sure. But in my mind, much better to go seek adventure.
Yeah.
Because at least the result, even if it ends up being a failure, it's the same as the couch method. So you might as well just go look for the adventure. That was, you know, that's always been my philosophy.
Well, Ben Queller, the new record is Cover the Mirrors, and you'll be performing on July 26th here at Crescent Ballroom. Thank you so much.
I can't wait. Oh, thank you so much for talking to me.
Just a washing his car, thinking about his pretty wife, making lemonade with the kitchen aid, making him a perfect.
And now for the latest in our summer soapbox series on the topic of misbehaving. Phoenix writer and lawyer Greg Esser is also a visual artist, a passion that started early and under the bed. We'll let him explain.
When I had a prolonged bout with Lyme disease in college, my mother gave me the Calvin and Hobbes book by Bill Waterston titled The Monster Under the Bed is Drooling. On the inside front cover of the book, Mom wrote, "Laughter is always the best medicine." Mom knew medicine well. As an 11-year-old child, she was diagnosed as having rheumatic fever, which was treated with prolonged bed rest for months. In fact, she had juvenile rheumatoid arthritis, which should have been treated with activity. The misdiagnosis allowed the disease to permanently damage Mom's joints with a progressive deterioration that continued throughout her life. From that point forward, Mom was on countless medications and steroids to manage her disease and pain. She had more than 40 surgeries to replace or fuse failing joints. She often joked she was more plastic and titanium than skin and bones. She never lost her sense of humor. That served her well given the unruly behavior of her two children. I was an artist from an early age. I used my crayons on just about every surface imaginable, from furniture and walls to the kitchen counter. I also apparently enjoyed hiding and playing in small spaces like cabinets and the round plastic laundry basket. Mom took and framed photographs of me as a child in these random places. My older sister had made similar mischief years before me when she was at a similar age, also documented in photographs by Mom. Our significant age difference as siblings is captured in the fact that the photographs of my sister are in black and white, and those of me are in color, with fading reds. One night, when I was about 5 years old, well after midnight, I crawled over the pink shag carpet in my sister's bedroom with my brand new box of 64 Crayola crayons. I slid stealthily under her bed while she was sleeping. Laying on my back, I began to make a colorful masterpiece on the clean white fabric stapled to the underside of the mattress box frame. The fabric was stretched tight like a canvas, although I was too young then to know what a canvas was. As I colored my composition, I couldn't help but notice the fabric had a little bit of give to it as I drew. Curious, I pushed the sharpened point of my crayon against the fabric a bit harder. It made a very satisfying little pop sound when it punctured the fabric, like popping bubble wrap. Very pleased with my discovery, I began to rapidly poke more holes in the fabric. My sister, who had, until that moment, been sleeping soundly, awoke with a start and screamed. Terrified by that scream, I bolted up, completely forgetting about the bed. I smashed my head into wood and cried out in pain. The loud thump of my head hitting the underside of her bed scared my sister even more. She screeched even louder, and now we were both crying. This all transpired over the span of several seconds. The ruckus pulled our parents out of their own sound slumber across the hallway. They stumbled into the room to see what was happening. My mother would retell the story about the monster under the bed for the rest of her life. Every time she would tell it, she would start laughing until tears started streaming down her face. It was impossible not to laugh with her.
That was Greg Esser. You can hear more from the Soapbox series at kjzz.org. And that's it for this Friday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, so much for being along. Don't forget to sign up for the show's weekly newsletter. It is called Radioheads. You can do that at theshow.kjzz.org. And follow us on Instagram. We are at KJZZ The Show. The show was produced by Sativa Peterson, Nick Sanchez, Amber Victoria Singer, Athena Ankra, and Ayanna Hamilton, as well as Bruce Drummond. Sky Shout is our digital editor, Chad Snow, the news director. The show is created by John Hoban. Our executive producer is Amy Silverman. For Sam Dingman and Lauren Gilger, I'm Mark Brody here in Phoenix. Have a terrific rest of your day. Have a great weekend. Hope to have you right back here on Monday.